Good morning.
Good morning.
Sixth case, 053571, Alex Gilbert versus Jay Merchant. Gilbert versus McCann. Hey, Ms. Mitchell.
May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Mitchell and I represent the petitioner Alex Gilbert. This court should reverse the district court's dismissal of Mr. Gilbert's petition and order that the court grant the writ of habeas corpus. The Illinois appellate court failed to analyze...
You've asked for an evidentiary hearing in the alternative. What does the AEDPA, the federal statute, say about evidentiary hearings?
It says that an evidentiary...
Now what standards have to be met to have a quarter evidentiary hearing?
I don't have the rule in front of me, Your Honor, the exact language, but I believe it refers to a new rule of law or the failure or the inability to develop record facts on the record below due to circumstances beyond the petitioner's control. And the reason that the evidentiary record was not developed here is because the trial court determined that it lacked jurisdiction over the substantive merits of Mr. Gilbert's claim and dismissed his petition on that basis, his post-conviction.
Well, the Illinois appellate court, it seems to me, understood Mr. Gilbert to be arguing only that his statement was involuntary and that his counsel should have moved to suppress it as such, and because he was not allowed to speak with his mother or to have her present during questioning. Now, if that was his sole argument, why was it unreasonable for the court to dispose of his claim without an evidentiary hearing?
There was sufficient evidence in the record as it existed to support a finding of involuntariness, and that is because the court is directed to look at all of the circumstances, the totality of the circumstances surrounding the confession, and not simply the single factor that the court looked at.
Okay. Beyond contending that an evidentiary hearing was necessary, did Mr. Gilbert ever make a proffer to the state court as to what such a hearing might reveal about the voluntariness of his statement?
He did not have the opportunity to make that proffer because the trial court dismissed it without holding, on its face.
The state trial court?
Yes, sir.
I mean, did he ever argue to the state court that there were factors other than his inability to speak with his mother or have her present during questioning that might show his statement to be involuntary?
Well, there was the factor of his age that was on the face of all of his post-conviction submissions to the court. The age of 14 and the court's direct, the Supreme Court and this court has recognized that there's extra care to be given to the confession of a juvenile. Most recently, this court in Butler looked at the fact...
I really have to have an answer to my question, and that is, did he ever make a proffer to the state court as to what such a hearing might reveal about the voluntariness?
In terms of the evidence he intended to submit at that at such a hearing, no, he did not. But... In terms of the evidence that existed on the face of the record, again, there was his age. There was the fact that counsel was not present during the interrogation. He was held in custody for approximately 10 hours. And although the record does not reveal what exactly happened during that 10-hour period, he was put in the lineup and at some point towards the end of the day gave his involuntary statement. Because the factors showed that Mr. Gilbert's confession was involuntary, his counsel was ineffective for failing to move to suppress it.
Now, of course, there is no per se right for a juvenile to consult a parent prior to questioning or to have a parent present during questioning. Is that not correct?
That's correct. There is no such per se right. But this court has recognized that when you have a juvenile, the presence of a parent is a very significant factor and can often tip the circumstances in favor of a finding of involuntariness.
Well, somewhere in the briefs there's a suggestion that Illinois is very exceptional by not requiring the presence of a parent. Is that right?
I'm not familiar with the reference that you're the reference in the briefs that you are making are referring
somewhere
to.
Somewhere in the brief suggests that to be the case. I was unaware of it.
And my problem is that what you have here is Gilbert making a purely legal argument that he was entitled to speak with his mother, and the law simply does not, as you've just properly conceded, the law just does not support that proposition.
Whether or not Mr. Gilbert was entitled to speak to his mother, that is simply one of the circumstances that the courts are to look at. And in fact, the courts are to probe into the capacity of a juvenile. Mr. Gilbert was 14 at the time of his statement, the capacity of him to understand what was going on in this law enforcement dominated environment and what the meaning of the rights being read to him were, what the meaning of waiving those rights was, whether he was giving the confession of his own free will or whether it was produced by adolescent fantasy fright or despair, as this court has recognized.
Well, the appellate court recognized that the refusal to allow him to speak with his mother or have her present during the questioning was a relevant factor. I mean, the appellate court cited the universe of relevant factors, but the appellate court understood that Gilbert was arguing that this alone, not allowing him to speak with his mother or have her present, that alone rendered his statement involuntary, and, you know, rejected that argument.
And the court should have looked beyond that lone factor, that even though it gave lip service to the set of circumstances.
What law are you relying on here? What law?
In terms of what the court is required to do?
The court didn't do here. I mean, the court, we often enough find, fault with what the courts do, but here the court, as I said, cited all of the relevant factors and concluded that he was relying on just the one factor.
The most recently, this court has recognized in the Butler case that the court is to give special consideration to the age of the juvenile confessing, and whether or not that confession was given, due to his own free will or his age, and the recognition of his age alone should have been given more credit by the appellate court, and simply dismissing the petition on the basis of his access to his mother or lack thereof was improper. I see my white light is on, so I'll reserve for rebuttal. Thank you.
Let me just ask you one more question, and that is this. Even if we assume that Gilbert's counsel would have been successful, suppressing his statement to the police officers, was there not significant additional evidence of his involvement in the killing, including in particular the identification and the statement of the eyewitness, Monica Collier?
The standard for the effective assistance of counsel is whether the result would have been different. And here, since it was a guilty plea, the question is whether there was a reasonable probability that Gilbert would have gone to trial instead of pleading guilty. And the little evidence that existed other than his confession was is not enough to raise or reduce his reasonable probability of going to trial, because the eyewitness testimony would have been tested through cross-examination at trial.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Gansner.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the Court, my name is Anderson Gansner. I'm the Assistant Attorney General here representing the respondent. Judge Rovner, I'd like to get right to your last question that you posed to petitioner's counsel. Even if you assume that petitioner satisfies the portion of prejudice which requires him to show that his statement would have been suppressed had it been challenged, and that the state appellate court was objectively unreasonable in holding otherwise, as you said, he still needs to show that there's a reasonable probability that he would have gone to trial had that statement been suppressed. That's under Hill versus Lockhart. And this court is required, specifically in Berkey versus United States, that in order to show that reasonable probability, you need to provide objective evidence. And the district court specifically denied the ineffective assistance of a counsel claim on the failure to provide any objective evidence. And that's on page A13 of the petitioner's
opinion. What did you just say? Articulate your last comment. I missed it.
Oh, certainly, Your Honor. The way the district court handled the ineffective assistance of counsel claim is it just went to that first part of the prejudice test, which was, can the petitioner show that there's a reasonable probability that he would have gone to trial had his statement been suppressed? And it looked at the fact that under this court's precedent in Berkey versus United States, he needs to show objective evidence. And it said that there is no objective evidence in the record before it that would show that petitioner was even contemplating going to trial given the evidence in this case. And I think that is validated quite clearly by the record, where you have petitioner stipulating and swearing that it's true and correct to the testimony, as Judge Rovner noted, of an eyewitness who saw him, who accurately described him to the police the night of the shooting, saw him point a crutch at the car of the victim, say, "That's folks," and words to the effect of "pop him or cap him." As overheard by two witnesses who were in the car in front of the victim, they heard him say, "cap his ass." And petitioner, excuse me, yes.
She was not the only witness who attributed words to the effect of "let's cap him" to Mr. Gilbert?
If you look on page RA15 of our appendix, Judge, the respondent's appendix, there's her stipulated testimony. And she says, "I saw him point the crutch at the car and say words to the effect of pop him or cap him." And petitioner also stipulated to evidence of two other witnesses who didn't hear petitioner say that, who didn't see petitioner say that, but overheard at the same time, the same place in the car, immediately in front of the victim, say the words "cap his ass," and then shots rang out as described at the same time in the same place as the eyewitness. And in addition to all of that, there was physical evidence that validated the recollection of the eyewitness about where people were standing and what kind of gun the shooter was using. The eyewitness also identified the shooter, even though he was apparently standing further away from the petitioner, by name. And the petitioner himself corroborated that identification in his own statement, and the eyewitness identified the shooter as well out of the lineup shortly thereafter. So there's a lot of evidence in the record that demonstrates that she was a good witness and was validated by other evidence in the case. And the petitioner stipulated to all of that, and on top of that, swore that all of this evidence against him was true and correct. That's on page 24 of our appendix. So given that, and as the district court noted, given his failure to provide any objective evidence that he would have gone to trial had his statement been suppressed, he fails to satisfy that first part of the prejudice analysis under Hill versus Lockhart to show that there was a reasonable probability that he would have gone to trial. And that prong, in addition to that, is due deference under the ADPA because the state court reached a holding that there was no prejudice. So petitioner would have to show that not finding a reasonable probability was objectively unreasonable. And he doesn't come anywhere close to doing that. So his ineffective assistance of counsel claim fails.
If there is anything problematic here, it seems to me to be there's never been a totality of circumstances analysis of this statement that was made by this juvenile, which seems to be prescribed by the Fair case and other Supreme Court authority. Now, we've had some discussion about whether there was a proffer made, and but the investigation in that area seems to have been limited to the absence of the mother from the interrogation room, mm-hmm. as far as I can make out. But there hasn't been all of these factors that are spelled out in Fair. We're never investigated at any level here.
Judge, respectfully,
I'm not sure what the significance of that, to be perfectly frank, but I find it troubling.
Judge, I don't think you need to be troubled, and that's because if you look at page 842 of the petitioner's appendix.
The Supreme Court was pretty emphatic about conducting this kind of an analysis.
Yes, I agree, Your Honor. And on page 842, the appellate court says, in determining whether the confession was voluntary, we must consider the totality of the circumstances. And it says...
Well, that's what they said.
That's what they said.
Nobody ever did it. That's my point. Yeah.
Judge, I think I disagree with that, and that's because the two things that were argued to it were only his age and the fact that he was 14. And there's some specific language where they say, the only evidence in front of us that shows or tends to show that it's involuntary are these two facts. They don't recount all of the evidence under the totality of the circumstances that shows it's voluntary, because they do that when they're going over the facts, and that's in the record in front of them if you look at the guilty plea hearing. Now, certainly they could have done that, but what they do is they just look at what he's arguing, and they say he pled guilty, looked at these things he pled guilty to, this isn't enough.
Is there a case that says in this context that the examination of the totality of the circumstances may be confined to only the specific points raised by the defendant?
Judge, I believe what the standard... I agree with you that it would be wrong for the appellate court to say, well,
or
this is just
like
what was argued to us.
A guilty plea where you got to examine a lot of things which may not be raised.
Right. Judge, I agree with you that it would be wrong for them to say, well, we don't even need to look at things that weren't argued to us. What you need to do is evaluate...
Case law talks about age, experience, education, background,
yes.
intelligence, et cetera,
yes.
et cetera. We don't know much about any of those.
Right.
Some of those things.
And certainly the Illinois Appellate Court could have been more thorough. But if you look over the record that was in front of them, which was basically just the transcript from the guilty plea hearing, pretty much everything in there, including all these facts that he stipulates to, which meet some of those factors that you're supposed to consider, those show that the statement was voluntary, not involuntary. And what the court does is it just lists out the factors that it thinks might tend to indicate that the statement is involuntary. It doesn't bother going through all of the facts that are in there, which show that the statement is, in fact, voluntary. And what this court is doing, and I agree that it would have been more thorough to do that, but what this court is doing, and as it's been instructed to do, for example, in Holland versus Jackson, is look back at the reasonableness of the court's decision in light of the record in front of it. And if you look at the record in front of the state appellate court at the time, which included this guilty plea transcript, which had the petitioner swearing that it was true and correct, that he was making a statement because he wanted to tell the truth about what happened, that he hadn't been threatened or promised anything, that a youth officer was with him when he made the statement, that he had been twice Mirandized by a youth officer, but not by a normal police officer, but by a youth officer, that because of that Mirandizing, he understood each of his rights, and that
he had been arrested before, had he not?
I'm sorry, Judge?
He had been arrested on prior occasions.
Yes, Judge. The record shows that he'd been arrested by the Chicago police and the ATF as part of a raid, I think just a block south of where the shooting occurred. And he'd also been a member of a gang for 2 years at that point. He stipulates to that. The evidence in the record shows that the statement occurred during the middle of the day, not late at night, early in the morning. He stipulated to that. He swore that it was true or correct, that he was sober, that he wasn't under the influence of drugs or alcohol, anything like that at the time. So there's lots of evidence in the record that demonstrates that the statement was voluntary. And the appellate court certainly could have been more thorough by going over those factors. But what we're doing here is determining whether its decision was reasonable in light of the record in front of it. And that's what Holland versus Jackson calls for. And under that, its decision here is not objectively unreasonable. If this court has no further questions, then we would rest on our brief and ask it to affirm the holding of the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mitchell.
Just a few points on rebuttal, Your Honors. In terms of the evidence that was on the record and considered by the Illinois Appellate Court, there are a number of the circumstances that are referred to in the list of the totality of the circumstances, such as intelligence, background, experience with law enforcement, whether or not the juvenile had the capacity to understand his rights. While the record reflects that he was read his rights, there was no analysis of his capacity to understand what those rights were. And while the record reflects that the problem that, and while the record reflects his age, there was no investigation into whether or not he had the intelligence to understand what was happening to him. And all of those, the lack of the investigation is due to the fact that there was no evidentiary hearing. At a minimum, this court should remand to the district court for the holding of an evidentiary hearing so that all of the facts can be developed to make a proper analysis of the circumstances surrounding Mr. Gilbert's confession. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Mitchell, you and your law firm, Mr. McQueen, took this case as pro bono and as an appointment, and we want you to know that you have the sincere thanks of the court for your willingness to do so and for the very fine job that you have performed for your client. Thank you. And as always, thanks to the Attorney General's office for the fine work that they're doing. Thank you. Okay, the case will be taken under advisement, and this court is in recess until tomorrow morning, and thanks to all of you for your kind attention.